Tonight, it's my great pleasure to interview Sharon M. Rifkin, MA, MFT. Sharon is a conflict resolution expert and licensed marriage and family therapist with 30 years private practice in Santa Rosa, California. Her website is www.sharonrifkin.com. That's www.sharonrifkin.com. Sharon is the author of Breaking the Argument Cycle, How to Stop Fighting Without Therapy, the book that reveals where the real conflict lies in the relationship and how to resolve it once and for all. And I have to say that when I first came across Sharon's book, I was skeptical. I thought, yeah, right. That has to be the kind of title that promises more than it can possibly deliver. And then when I read it, I was totally convinced. It has a kind of blinding brilliance about it that once someone finally reveals it to you, you say, yes, of course, that's perfectly obvious. And it changes everything I ever thought. It's a book that really can change lives by changing the course of relationships. So Sharon Rifkin, welcome, and I'm really looking forward to speaking to you and finding out how you discovered the argument cycle and how to break it.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure, a great pleasure. So could you start by telling us a little bit about how you discovered the argument cycle when you were first in? When you first realized that you were in it?
Yes, I discovered it from a relationship that I was in that I'm sure we can all relate to. I couldn't be in it, but I couldn't get out of it, and I was stuck, literally. And I started to think about it. Well, I thought about it all the time, looking for some avenue, and I was literally at a 4th of July, and for us that's Independence Day in the United States, ironically, because it really was that night that I discovered my independence, but I was sitting there amongst the fireworks and really thinking about the most recent argument that I'd had with my boyfriend at the time, and I realized that it was the same argument that we'd been having from the very beginning. And so I realized that that first argument that a couple has, and really anyone in a relationship, I say couple because that's where it usually shows up the most, but this can be with coworkers, it can be with your, you know, children, it can be with really anybody. But for me, it was my boyfriend, and I realized that that first argument that we had had about a fence was the same argument we were continuing to have throughout the relationship. And that two things. One, that argument about the fence, he said that he never promised to build me a fence, and I said he promised to build me a fence, and you can, you know, one of those that you say, he said, she said, and nobody gets anywhere. I realized that that never got resolved, but even more important, I realized that that first argument was very much linked to my past and the issues in my past, because when I was young, my sister called me UG, which stood for ugly, and I believed her for years that I was ugly, and so I tended to believe somebody else's truth above my own. And one day when I was 12, I looked in the mirror and realized I wasn't ugly, and it was a shock to my whole system, but I realized that my boyfriend was doing the same thing, that he was telling me things that, well, I didn't promise to build you a fence, and I was believing him over my own truth of knowing he had told me he was going to build me a fence. So I was repeating my childhood trauma, and I began to test out that theory that the first argument that people have is either the beginning of the end or the beginning of the beginning, because if you know that it links to your past, you can immediately start understanding it better and understanding why you're fighting. So that was the start for me, and then I tested it out on myself and clients, and came to see that it was quite true, the power of that first argument.
Yeah, it's an amazing realization.
It was. And you know, in a way, like you said, it's so right in front of you. Like, why wouldn't, you know, the first thing that happens in a relationship sort of repeat itself? But we don't think about that. And the other thing with the first argument, rather than looking at it, we tend to want to sweep it under the rug because, oh, you know, we don't want to be out of our blissful state and, oh, this will go away and it's not that important. But it is the most important argument that you're going to have because it sets the stage for everything else in the relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. I love this thought that it seemed to be a fence, but it wasn't a fence that it was really about. It was just the way your relationship didn't work.
Exactly, and that's the thing, you know, people fight all the time about fences and, you know, inanimate objects, fences, cookies, wastebaskets, pies. I mean, I've had people fight about everything, and part of you knows, how could I be this upset about cookies or pies or fences? You know, I'm ready to just, you know, I'm screaming at my partner. So that's the first clue when your reaction to something, you know, really so inanimate and so neutral, like a cookie, becomes World War III, you know that you've been triggered in your core or childhood issues, or your, it's your story below the story, as I say in my book. It's what's underneath the fence or underneath the cookies that brings the anger, you know, about that situation. But it's never about that. It's always about, you know, what's really at stake, which for me, it was, you know, my own integrity at that point, that I needed to trust myself above, you know, all others.
Yeah. I know that in your book you use this beautiful phrase, the wound of not trusting your own perceptions.
Yes.
And when I read that, that was an absolute light bulb moment for me, and has been also for a lot of the women that I work with.
Oh, yes. I mean, and that's what I think happens, and, you know, what you talk about with abusive relationships and the repetitive cycle is that we do not trust our own perceptions, our own truth, our own value, our own intuition. We give it away so easily to those that we love and somehow think that they know more than we do. Like my sister, I gave, you know, she was older than me, and that's very typical. Mm-hmm. I thought she knew more than I did, and I really never even looked at myself in the mirror for years, because I was so convinced I was ugly, and I guess I really didn't want to see what she was telling me I was. And then the day that I looked, I have to tell you, I blinked my eyes. I kept looking around to see if maybe somebody else was standing there besides me. And there it was. It was me. And not ugly. Yeah, it was quite something.
And an indication of your own emotional robustness that you actually saw what was there, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that I, you know, have always been a survivor, so to speak. And that was the beginning of, you know, a whole new life for myself, because little did I know, and I really didn't know this till I was older, it really wasn't that moment. It wasn't that moment that I began to trust myself, you know, more than, you know, begin that process. And obviously, I didn't, you know, fully complete that process when I had this boyfriend. He really helped me to complete that process, because everything I said was put into doubt, because he wanted to control me.
Yes. And I do love the little piece you mentioned about the power of fantasy, what it was that you loved about him.
Oh, he was your ticket to fantasy. Very, very, very handsome, like a movie star. And, you know, had the ability, and I think many abusive people, men, have the ability to read your mind and tell you, oh, they're going to give you this and give you that. And, you know, it's just, it's like I said, it felt too good to be true. And in fact, it was too good to be true. But in the beginning, I couldn't resist it. I literally could not resist it. I went, you know, and like you talk about, I fell very deeply in love and justified the behavior, his behavior and his abusiveness, because I loved him so much. I did, in fact, love him so much, but too much, because it was at my expense at a certain point.
Yeah. And you speak about the power of hooks, which relates very much to this loving too much or loving inappropriately. Can you say a little about hooks?
Yeah, hooks are those elements that literally hook us, you know, trigger us is another word that I could use, into our childhood memories and into our childhood patterns. Mm-hmm. They, you know, it's almost like you have an open wound that is waiting for the right person, or, quote, the wrong person. It's the right wrong person to come along and just say the right thing that just gets you very hooked. And it's both, you know, it can feel very good at in one sense, because it's like, wow, he understands me, and he knows what I like, and nobody's seen me like he sees me. And you get hooked, because for me, I wasn't really seen in my family, as we can tell if somebody was calling me Ugg. And by the way, my parents never bothered to correct my sister or to tell me, no, you're not ugly, you're actually really pretty. Nobody bothered. So I was a child that wasn't seen. So when he saw me, I thought, it was very powerful, and I would call that a hook. And then at the same time, I got so hooked into, you know, thinking I had been seen by him and that, you know, this was too good to be true, that I started to believe his truth over mine. And I think that's what happens, that the hook gets us back into our childhood programming, and it's as if we're back in our families of origin. And the good part is that when you get hooked, you do have the opportunity to heal, because it's through that getting hooked and replaying the childhood patterns that healing, in fact, can take place, which is why I say this man that almost destroyed me in many ways really gave me life like no other, because I really looked at my childhood issues as I never had before. I had to, in order to get out of the relationship.
Yes, so he really was the agent of your stepping into adulthood and taking charge of your own feelings and your own life.
Absolutely, and I'm very grateful to him, very grateful. I couldn't be with him, but my gratitude is very very high, because, you know, he was a mirror. And my gratitude to myself is very high, because I took it that way. I could have gone many different ways in this relationship, including being destroyed by it. But I think, like you're saying, my robustness, my resilience came through once again, and brought me to, you know, probably the healthiest place I had ever been in my life up to that point.
I'm glad to hear you mention your gratitude to yourself as well in that.
Absolutely.
It's fundamental.
Yes, absolutely.
But you say that there are three great obstacles to exchanging opinions or arguing in a productive way. Can you say a little about those?
Yes, they're shaming and blaming, and the need to be right, and God, to refresh me on what the third one is, because my mind just went absolutely blank.
I'm sorry. One of those things, you write a book, and then you can sometimes leave it a bit on the back burner, and other people come up to you and have read it and quoted at you and go, ah! It's actually, you said the need to be right and blaming and shaming were two different obstacles.
Oh, okay. So that, okay, I wasn't sure about that. Thank you, but you're absolutely right. People tell me, oh, you said this, and I went, oh, yeah, I do remember that, mm-hmm. But I know very well the shaming, blaming, and needing to be right. They are the three huge obstacles, because in communication with your partner, and this doesn't happen in the beginning. Remember, in the beginning, you know, we love our partner. We give them the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. They're our best friend. They're our ally. And as time goes on and these arguments that I'm talking about remain unresolved and resentment builds and often contempt builds and hatred, your partner becomes your enemy and you don't give them the benefit of the doubt and everything starts to change. And that comes from, and then you want to hurt your partner. And so that's where the shaming and the blaming, where you think of something that you just want to make your partner feel bad or blame them. And it's the worst thing you can do in communication is to shame someone and blame them. You know, you always do this to me. You're an idiot. You're a terrible person. We should never talk to people we love in that manner. And yet we do, because we've been hurt and then we try to hurt back. So, and that's the part of defending and attacking your partner. So you really, if any relationship has gotten to the point where all most communication is shaming your partner, blaming your partner, you're in trouble and you need to, you know, get some help or take a look at things, because there are many ways that you can tell somebody you're unhappy or you don't like what they're doing without going after their character and without making them wrong and without attacking them. Because if you get attacked, the only way to answer is to defend yourself. If I'm going to be attacked, I'm going to defend myself. So you want to say to your partner, you know, this doesn't work for me, or I'm unhappy with this. I know I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. I'm sure you didn't mean to say it that way, but this is how I took it. This is how I'm hearing it. You know, you really explain how you're feeling rather than, you always do this to me, you're never there for me, you don't care about me, you obviously hate me. You know, you. And then the need to be right is just really a deadly thing. And most of us in our relationships want to prove our point. We want to be right. We don't really care who we're hurting, just that we want to be right. And the reason we want to be right is because we think our partner is accusing us of being wrong and of being stupid or of being, you know, thoughtless. And so we're going to defend our point. And what people do in arguments is they get louder and louder about, you know, their point of view, thinking that their partner's going to hear them better if they're louder, or hear them better if they attack their partner. And we just keep repeating this same negative cycle that really doesn't work. Why do we think we're going to get our point across just by screaming? So you want to, you know, really evaluate, do I really need to be right here? Or do I need to listen to my partner? Do I need to express what's going on and, you know, my feelings? And you know, what's so important about being right? I mean, really, a lot of times when you can admit you're wrong, it's really the stronger position to take, because you're being more vulnerable and more human and more open to your partner.
Yeah. For myself, I remember that I would meet blame and shame with the need to be right.
Yes, absolutely.
It's
because
my way of coping.
Exactly. Because you don't know what else to do. You know, because you feel so helpless, your partner's not listening to you. They're attacking you in some way. And so, yeah, you want to, you know, I've had people get out the encyclopedia. Now you can just Google things to prove your point and prove that you're right, which couples do all the time now. They take out their cell phones and start, see, it's in Wikipedia. here's my proof. So, you know, we can instantly be right. But again, even if we're right, and often we are. Somebody's, you know, usually right. Sometimes two people are right. But even if we are right, we don't really win anything. We haven't really gotten any further in our ability to communicate or understand or love each other. All we've proven is that we're right. But it does not solve the issues, and it doesn't really give us any kind of peace of mind.
No. So that brings us back to the story below the story, I think.
Yes. Yes, the story below the story is the real story, like the real story of the fence with my boyfriend was, you know, he had promised me to build a fence, and the truth is he freaked out after promising me to build a fence because he felt he was, you know, committing too much, or he was being controlled by me, or I was the boss. I mean, some, you know, because that was all his childhood issues. And then my childhood issues was I couldn't, you know, I didn't trust myself. And so I wondered, well, did he promise to build me a fence? Maybe he didn't. You know, I would always question my own memory. And so the story below the story, we're here with two people thinking we're talking about a fence, but really we're two children fending for ourselves and trying to survive the way we did in our childhood and trying to be okay with ourselves. And the result was a bitter argument. And who was right, and he was right, and I was right, and, you know, and off we went. And from that point forward, those were the dynamics in the relationship, him feeling controlled and then turning around and trying to control me, and me, you know, being controlled because I didn't trust my own perceptions, you know, well enough to hang in there.
Yeah.
So the story below the story is, you know, the truth of what's really going on underneath the argument, the real story.
Yeah. I'm just thinking back. I can remember my husband saying things like, why do we always end up having the same argument, and why do other things always seem to come in? He's pretty good at bringing other things in, but they're all sort of part of that story.
Right.
Or illustrations of the story. He did that one as well, and that one, and that one, and that one. And they all prove the same point.
Exactly.
Because we never addressed it.
Well, that's the thing. We don't resolve arguments, right? Because we don't address the real problem. We don't ask the right questions. We're saying, you know, why don't you want me to build? You know, why won't you build me a fence? Well, that's not the right question. The question is, I think you feel controlled, or I think you're unhappy with me, or something's going on here. This can't really be about a fence. So we never get the right answers because we never ask the right questions because we don't know what we're really fighting about. We don't know there's a story below the story. We think it's about a fence.
Yeah.
You know, we're convinced.
And if we are, and if we're in this story below the story and being this child, it's no wonder we can't behave like adults.
Exactly. Because we're not in that moment.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So how do you? Yeah. But how do you actually start to clear away this baggage and do things differently?
Well, the first thing is that you need to figure out what your core issue are, what your story below the story is. You need to know what your hooks, what your trigger points are. So it goes back to self-realization. You know, what triggers me, you know, and then, you know, knowing those triggers so that when I get triggered, I don't fall into the trap. I can say, ooh, something's happening, and I need to address the trigger. And then I can, you know, at least say to my partner, you know, wait a minute, you know, I'm getting triggered and or I'm getting hooked and I need to talk about this, or I need some time to think about it, and not just have the hair trigger reaction of like, well, how could you say that to me? And, you know, and then, you know, start blaming and shaming and doing my thing with my partner. So you start with yourself. And, you know, and hopefully your partner will want to start with him or herself to be looking in the mirror And then you can start having a whole different kind of conversation. And the other thing is you want to know the importance of the first argument. You know, when that first argument happens, you want to invite in that conflict and say, what can you teach me? And because right there you've got the two stories. And once you know what your core issue is or your story below the story, that's what's always going to get triggered. So you sort of have cut to the, you know, chase. You know, the common denominator is always going to be your core issue getting triggered. And if you know that, you can go right to the core issue and start talking about how you got triggered rather than, you know, did you take the garbage out or did you move the wastebasket? Or, you know, we waste our time on these trivial things that we think are the real argument. So it's and then you practice. You know, you practice you know, not blaming and not shaming and not having to be right, and you know, have different ways that you can stop an argument, you know, take a time out or call a truce or different things that you can always salvage what's happening and not take it to that very low level where you're just, quote, beating on each other. And that takes, the beginning, it takes self-awareness and understanding, you know, why you're reacting and knowing what questions to ask and knowing what you're really fighting about. Once you know what you're really fighting about, it's like a miracle. It's like, you know, with a big ball of yarn that's all knotted up, but you get that one string and you pull it, and then the whole ball of yarn sort of straightens itself up. That's what the first argument, knowing that and having awareness of that in your core issue, can do to a relationship. But do you pull the right string and straightens things out? And then you don't have the buildup. You can stay current. Yeah, sorry. What'd you say?
Yeah, and that's just stunning because you know, it's so easy to think of the first argument as the aberration.
Yeah.
Well, we messed up this time, but it won't happen again.
Right.
It's just
right.
A blip.
Right.
And obviously it's not.
Right. It's the opposite.
So
we should be saying, oh, my God, it's happened. It's going to happen again, and it's going to get worse. Let's do something now.
Yeah. So rather than trying to sweep it under the carpet, you really need to work through it. And what would you say are the biggest indications that you are going to be able to work through conflict successfully with a partner, starting from argument number one?
I think the biggest indicators would be, number one, are you both open to looking at this differently and not having to blame? Now, a lot of people are very invested in blaming and shaming. And if you're with somebody that says, well, that's ridiculous, it's just you, and if you know, would just change, then life would be perfect. If you've got a partner that persists in that behavior, I would say that's trouble. And that's not going to be a very good partnership because you've got to, you know, have somebody that's open to possibilities, that isn't just judging you, that isn't just, you know, in a way out to get you. So I think an indicator of success would be a willingness to look at your own stuff, to look in the mirror. Somebody that's not willing to look at their own stuff, you really can't negotiate with them. And the healthiest relationships are those where you can negotiate. You know, I tell my point, you tell your point. Let's problem solve. Let's be adults. Let's not be those little kids like you were just talking about that can't really negotiate. Let's be, you know, let's be grown-ups about this. I think people that, you know, have a strong sense of themselves and have their own lives, they're not just dependent on the relationship to give them, you know, goodies. I think that's a very, you know, a very important thing for success in a relationship. Mm-hmm. I think that the controlling relationships and the abusive ones are usually people with, you know, pretty low self-esteem and want their partner to be everything to them. You know, what's the old saying, you know, make me, you make me a better person, you know, my other half. I mean, Those are very dangerous signs, in my opinion. I don't want another half. I just want my whole to enhance your whole.
Yeah.
And that's those are the healthiest relationships. So, you know, willingness, I think willingness to look beyond the surface is probably a good indicator of success, of potential success. And,
yeah,
you know, somebody...
Yeah,
what'd you say?
Sorry. I said that makes an awful lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, the person that says, oh, gee, I can see your point. I mean, that's like, you know, heaven when somebody says that. You can see my point? Wow. Okay, then, you know, and then you know you're on the right track. In my book, I do have part of a chapter that talks about, you know, certain signs of, like, character disorder and abusiveness that, you know, if you see those signs in your relationship, you really should get some help, look into it. These are warning signs of trouble. And I'd listed, you know, a number of signs, and, you know, of extreme situations. And, you know, those are always good to know. Because, like you say, we kid ourselves and we think, oh, I love the person, or, you know, I can forgive them, or I understand. And, you know, we do ourselves a disservice, you know, for way too many years thinking that this is something that we can work with. And oftentimes you just can't. There's certain people, you know, that you pick that really are harmful to you. And all the love in the world is not going to change that.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, it sometimes makes it... What did you say? Sorry.
Love is not a magic wand.
No, no, it is not a magic wand. I mean, it's a necessary in relationships, you know, to give you... you know, connection, but it is not going to take away certain things. And we think it will. I used to think love will cure everything and anything if I just love him enough, if he just loves me enough. And the Lucas, the man that I write about in the book, you know, that he proved to me, that relationship proved to me, love sometimes is not enough because I never stopped loving him. That wasn't the issue, but I could not be with him because of, you know, the abuse, the verbal abuse, mental abuse. So love did not conquer all.
No, not least because loving him was required that you couldn't love yourself terribly.
Exactly. And that's the key. If you're loving someone and at your own expense and you're, you know, whittling away your self-esteem and everything else, then not a healthy love.
No. So can you, because this is an area which really fascinates me and a lot of people, can you say something about the nature of healthy love? Because I think it's something we don't get enough exposure to in our society, you know, with Hollywood turning out these nauseating fantasies and everything.
Exactly. I know fantasy is key because I think we think healthy love is, you know, the fantasy and living happily ever after and, you know, passion and, you know, all these, you know, sort of dramatic showings of love. Now, I think healthy love is kind of quiet, and it's, you know, an understanding, maybe, you know, a little gesture that maybe nobody even notices except your partner. It's having respect and regard and acceptance and tolerance. Tolerance for your, you know, foibles, for your partner's foibles, trusting that they're not out to hurt you, giving them the benefit of the doubt, you know, accepting their faults, accepting your own faults, knowing that most of the time we're just being human and we're not meaning to hurt each other. You know, I think love is really appreciating, you know, gratitude for that person, you know, knowing, you know, their issues and maybe what it takes for them to get through a day and really appreciating that. And, yeah, we make mistakes and we hurt our loved ones, you know, not on purpose. And, you know, forgiveness. Forgiving ourselves, forgiving another person. But I think gratitude's, I work with couples, and a lot of times in order to get them back on track, because they do have a potential for a good relationship, just telling people we're grateful. Just like you're saying, how often do we talk about healthy love? We always talk about, well, the negative or this is bad. But what about the gratitude? There's something to be grateful for towards your partner every day, at least one thing. And start with one, you know, and go from there. That can start. Gratitudes are an antidote for greed, for envy, for anger. You start being grateful, and your energy just shifts immediately. And you have more regard for yourself and for your partner. And I think that, you know, healthy love is recognizing when you need to talk about things that are hard and that, you know, you... respect your partner's point of view. It's listening. You know, talking nicely. And I don't mean nicely. When we're angry, maybe we don't talk nicely, but you don't have to defame them or blame and shame them. You can say a lot of things, you know, with a tone of voice, with getting your point across. It doesn't have to, you know, put somebody down like you're an idiot or you're stupid. You should never say that to people you love. You just, and never. It shouldn't be in the vocabulary. Yeah. So I think it's, and you know, I think the healthier we are as humans, as our own individual selves, the more compassion we have for ourselves and the more empathy we have for ourselves, the better we're able to love somebody else. Because without compassion for ourselves, you can't really have compassion for anybody else, you know, for their mistakes.
Yes, absolutely. And when you are absolutely desperate for love and affection, you can be a little bit demanding when
yes.
you want your needs met.
Yes. Yes, and I think we expect our partners, you're here to fulfill my needs. Well, who's told you that? Nobody's there to fulfill anybody else's needs. That is not, that's wrong. That's not, that's a myth. You know, I'm here to be on my path to heal myself, and then I can reach out to someone and be there for someone. But I'm not here to fulfill your needs, and you're not here to fulfill mine. I've got to do that myself. That's part of the path we walk. And if we don't, we gyp ourselves, really, because we never become the total humans we can be.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess that one of the reasons that is not so much in the public consciousness from Hollywood and so on is because it doesn't make sensational viewing, does it?
No, it
doesn't. You can't imagine a film with Tom Cruise.
Right.
Where he's just going on a spiritual journey and he just becomes a more gentle, wise person as it goes on.
Exactly. I mean, we're addicted to, you know, drama. It's like we're addicted to sugar. It's that same rush,
yeah.
the adrenaline rush,
yeah.
whether it's sugar or, you know, drugs or, you know, drama. We're very addicted to that as a culture. And so a quiet love or a, you know, a comforting love isn't going to make the paparazzis don't have much to go on. You know, it'd be boring.
No, it's pretty baffling. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But it is a lovely word for it, a quiet love.
Yes.
Something that you actually have to pay attention to.
Yes. And if you're...
That's very worth it.
Yes. And if you, you know, just look at it on the surface, people might miss the depth of it. Because I think a quiet love is quite deep. And you almost have to feel it rather than see it, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes. It looks very different to passion.
Yes.
And the thing I hear from women all the time is chemistry. What are your thoughts on chemistry? You know, there's got to be the chemistry there.
I know. And then how many people with those chemistry relationships are happy? I'd love to do a survey on that, because those are the ones you've got to be the most careful about. It's the chemistry that gets in our way because it's a drug. You know, when we're that passionate and that head over heels or that love is blind, that's the drug of our endorphins or what, you know, that gets going. And it feels good and it's lovely and it's wonderful, but don't make it anything more than it is. It's often just a passionate connection. It is chemistry, but that doesn't mean that that's a good choice for a long-term relationship. And I'm not saying you should be with someone who you're not attracted to or there's no chemistry, but it doesn't have to be the fireworks that we think it has to be. And I think many young people right now are not getting, you know, or not committing because they have this picture and this ideal of the chemistry, of the, you know, rockets going off, and, you know, they turn away probably some very good relationships because, it's quieter. I think chemistry can come in many different forms, but I think when people talk about chemistry, they talk about, whoa, you know, he knocked my socks off, and I can't stay away from him, and I think that's when you have to say, I got to be careful. Because this could be one of those relationships that's, you know, not a good match, even though there's chemistry. And those are the ones we ignore. What'd you say?
I agree with you totally.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are the ones that you know, we ignore the signs that I was talking about. That, you know, you can tell, or maybe I was saying this earlier, but I always say within 24 hours of meeting somebody, if you really look and if you're really conscious, you can see what all the issues are, the good, the bad, the ugly, but we ignore them. And when we have chemistry with someone, we really ignore the warning signs. I mean, we ignore them for years because we hold on to that chemistry.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this thought that within 24 hours you can see all the warning signs. How do you go about that?
Well, I think that when you're conscious and when you really know what, you know, you really listen with that other ear and you see with those other eyes and you're looking for the story below the story and you're looking for red flags, you will hear something that doesn't quite add up. You'll see something that doesn't quite add up. You'll get a feeling. And, you know, I'm not saying that those are red flags that are terrible. I'm just saying pay attention. Because within that window of time, that very short window of time, everybody presents themselves. Even though we're trying to put our best foot forward and we're putting on our best face, there's going to be little things that are there that if we listen close enough and watch close enough, we're going to go, okay, I've got to be aware of that. You know, like if the person is, you know, 20 minutes late on your first date, that's a sign. Just notice it. You know, that's going to be an issue. And if you're somebody that can't stand people being late, you really better notice that because that person's already showing you something about themselves, and we don't pay attention because, oh, he's so cute or she's so nice or, you know, we have the same birthday, you know. We both like carrots. You know, it can be anything.
Yes, we like the same music, so he must be all right.
Exactly.
We were both bullied at school.
Yes.
Mind-boggling.
Yes, and we ignore, you know, that he's a little late or, you know, or he's really early or, I mean, any of those things. I mean, it's, you know, I can tell. I do the same thing with clients, you know, when a client calls me. I can tell very quickly what, you know, the issues are going to be, you know, because they're they'll stay true to their pattern. If somebody, you know, can't find my house the first time, then, you know, there's something about that that I'm, you know, going to be part of the therapy or going to be how they deal with me. You know, they always forget their checkbook. You know, people's patterns are right there. And you know, we need to look at them because certain patterns are not going to be compatible with ours. Certain patterns are fine. I mean, I don't really care that much. I mean, I don't like people to be late, but it's not a real pet peeve of mine. So if I have somebody that's running a little late, it's not going to matter that much. But that's me. If I'm somebody that really can't stand people being late, I don't want to be with someone that's late all the time. It'll be a huge, huge issue.
Yeah, I know for myself that punctuality is not my strongest suit, and it's important to my partner, not that he judges, but he can be stressed by not being on time for things.
Yes.
So I make superhuman efforts to be on time whenever.
Yeah.
Because it's about understanding what's underpinning this as well, isn't it?
Exactly. He's not trying to be, you know, controlling necessarily or mean to you because he wants you to be on time. Yeah. That's just important to him, and that's a really good point. We need to know those things that are important to our partners and try to, please them in that way. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not going to hurt you to be on time.
No.
You know, I mean, it may take some effort. But it's not something that you have to, you know, cut into yourself in order to do something that you know, gives him less stress. And, you know, and that's the thing with knowing what your triggers are and knowing what your hooks are. It's exactly that. It builds intimacy and connection if used in the right way because you know, punctuality is important to him. I'm not so great with punctuality, but, you know, I can make that happen because, you know, I love him. And why not? But if you didn't know that, you might go, oh, my God, he's just always on me for being late. And, you know, and then it can all be misunderstood. And instead, it can be a tool like you're using, you know, to build connection. And gratitude and appreciation and all those things that we talked about with healthy love.
Yeah. And compassion.
And compassion.
Yeah, something means something to another person for a reason.
Well, and that's...
Whether it's good or not.
Exactly. And that's when you look at the first argument and you get down to the story below the story and you start to understand why somebody is upset, not because they're trying to make your life miserable. You suddenly have compassion. You know, I had a couple that literally, I mentioned cookies, they literally fought about cookies. She baked cookies, he brought too many to work. She thought he didn't listen to her. He thought she was, you know, over the top with controlling, with the cookies. Turns out, you know, she never got listened to as a kid. And she, especially by her father, she was never valued. So being heard, she didn't want him to take too many cookies, was important. He grew up in foster homes and never had a family. So if he has a chance to share with his work family, he's going to take enough cookies to share. Well, once they understood where that was coming from, of course she said he could take as many cookies as he wanted. And of course he understood that, well, let me ask her first before I just take the cookies. And there you go. And it wasn't about cookies at all, but they were ready to, you know, they were not being very nice to each other and fighting over the cookies. So you understand the story below the story, and suddenly they have compassion for each other.
Yes, so potentially there is a massively powerful tool for creating great connection.
Yes, absolutely.
In the first argument.
Yes, and the quicker you get to it, the quicker you have those tools and the connection. And then each argument, instead of building a wall, which it will when you don't resolve it, it builds connection.
Yeah.
Because you have the tools to resolve it, and it doesn't fester.
Yeah. That's just wonderful. One of the phrases that I love is that good relationships are capable of just improving exponentially.
Yeah.
If you work them right. That's a concept that really works for me. Is that one that you subscribe to?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's endless. Just like arguments can be endless, the goodness in relationships can be endless, and you can really help each other and support each other and, you know, build with each other. And, the sum is more than the sum is more than the, its parts. Mm. I forget that, but you know that phrase, the sum is more than the total of its parts. That's that exponentially, that it can just keep going.
Yeah.
Because there's no bounds to love. You know, love is infinite. And if you can create love rather than misery and anxiety and stress, you know, there are no bounds.
And that is such a beautiful thought.
Yeah.
I think that's an absolutely wonderful thought on which to close, because...
Yeah. Yeah.
That is such a wonderful statement. There are no bounds on love. It's infinite. Sharon Rifkin, I would like to thank you again for letting me interview you. It has been wonderfully enlightening. For people who want to know more about your work, and I'm sure people will, they can go to your website, www.sharonrifkin.com, and your wonderful book, which I think we've only touched on really the value that it brings tonight, but it is amazing, and that is Breaking the Argument Cycle: How to Stop Fighting Without Therapy. So many, many thanks for speaking to me tonight. It's been wonderful.
Well, thank you, Annie. It's been wonderful on my end, too. This has been a deep pleasure, very much for me.
Well,
so thank you.
Well, thank you, Sharon. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.